Number one, bonds, not stocks. Number two, Reddit. And number three, Elvis, ladies and gentlemen, is back in the building. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, October the 4th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been a day of big numbers on Wall Street, most of them printed or displayed on screens anyway in red ink, triple-digit losses on the Dow, a 1.8% drop on the NASDAQ. But we are going to get going with a technically smaller but arguably more revealing number than either of those two. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, the benchmark 10-year, I should add, sits right now at 3.19%. That's the highest that yield, the interest rate that that bond pays. It's the highest it's been since 2011. We got Marketplace's Sabri Benishore on the phone from New York to talk all things bonds and put this into some context. Hey, Sabri.
Hey there, Kai.
So look, I was listening, I think actually it was you yesterday on the Marketplace Morning Report giving me the yield on the 10-year. It was 3.09. So here we are almost 36 hours later. It is a tenth percentage point higher. What gives?
Okay, so generally speaking, this is happening because the economy is doing great. Now, okay. Why specifically yesterday? I mean, like it's like if you're trying to push a car out of a ditch, why did it suddenly move that second? You know, but one reason could be that there was a very good number, ISM index of non-manufacturers, service industries. That was near a record high yesterday. But generally, you know, you have low unemployment, 3.9%. Mm-hmm. GDP growth rate, unrevised 4.2% second quarter.
Yeah.
All of this great news, and it just keeps on piling up and piling up, means that A, investors could be thinking that inflation is coming. Okay, uh-huh. So, and if inflation is going to be actually coming, we also saw oil prices rise, yep. are rising, right? So if they think inflation is coming, then that could eat into their long-term investment. And a 10-year treasury is a long-term investment, so they're going to need a higher yield. The other thing is that this could be telling us that investors believe the Fed is going to keep on keeping on raising rates, and so that influences the
which is what Jay Powell has talked about, and we'll get back to Powell in a minute. But let me ask you two sort of I think related questions. The first is, what do rising American interest rates mean in a global economy? We have talked about emerging markets on this program before. Some of the problems they're having. Give me the framing.
Well, the better things are doing here, the more money this is going to suck out of the riskier parts of the world. So, you know, pity Turkey and pity Argentina.
Right.
You know, if you're an institutional investor out in the world and you were looking, just scraping for the bottom of the barrel for somewhere to put your money, you know, you were playing around with Turkey, playing around with Argentina, playing around with all these other places. And the better the U.S.
scraping, because that's risky over there, right? That's the deal.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's risky. Yeah, it's super risky, financially unstable, lots of political problems, you know. And so, rosier things are here. People are like, I'm just gonna put this money back in the U.S. And that hurts those countries' currencies.
Okay. But if I have been living on my savings account interest rates and my certificates of deposit interest rates, which for a decade now have been bupkis, basically, isn't this admittedly small tick upward a sign of hope?
Yeah, it is. Yes, that's right. Savings account returns are going to go up. That's exactly right. Now, on the other hand, so is your credit card rate. So is your mortgage. It's not a surprise that the 30-year national average mortgage rate is also at a multi-year high just with this 10-year bond yield. So both ends.
All right. Back to Jay Powell super quick. We got a half a minute. He sits there, the chairman of the Fed does, and he sees the bond market reacting in the way that in theory he wants, right? He wants he's been raising rates and he wants this to keep ticking up. What's he thinking?
He's thinking, good, great. That's what I want. That's what should happen. Everyone's getting the message. And also, it's happening while the economy is doing great. So it's working out.
Which is even better. Sabri Benishore in New York talking bonds. Thanks, Sabri.
Sure.
All right. Talk to you soon. It's going to be interesting to see what happens, by the way, with those bond yields tomorrow morning, say 8:30 or so East Coast time, when we get the September unemployment report. Best guesses are it's going to be pretty good. Lots of new jobs, a new low, low rate on unemployment, which becomes a big deal when you think about this. We are getting oh so close to the holiday hiring season, right? And given the strength of the economy that Sabri was just talking about, holiday sales are expected to be pretty strong, too, which means stores are going to be busy, which means they're going to have to be hiring. So what's a would-be employer to do in the search for those new hires? Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
You don't have to tell stores that workers are hard to come by. Jack Kleinhens with the National Retail Federation says just look at when retailers are posting holiday jobs this year.
They're announcing these openings much earlier than what we'd seen in the past.
He says stores are starting to raise wages to attract seasonal workers. They're also offering incentives like signing bonuses, additional training, and more employee discounts.
I believe one of the companies out there was even thinking of providing a 401k.
But even though the unemployment rate is so low, there are still plenty of people willing to take on more work.
Seasonal workers are often people who are working second or third jobs.
That's economist Teresa Ghilarducci at the New School. She says stores know that higher wages will bring in people who need the extra income.
There's really no such thing as a labor shortage in economics.
Higher pay could cut into profits for retailers and make gift buying more expensive for shoppers. But look, these are good problems to have. The National Retail Federation said holiday sales are expected to jump by more than 4% this year. Economist Sarah House at Wells Fargo says workers are benefiting too.
We saw it this week with Amazon increasing their minimum wage. We've seen Target and Walmart increase the level that they're bringing in workers.
She says retailers could ask employees to work longer hours instead of bringing more people on. That would be good for existing workers if they need those hours. Bad for shoppers who'd have to wait in longer lines at the checkout counter with fewer employees around. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, we did that, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been an interesting day in the U.S.-China economic relationship. A big story in Bloomberg Business Week, maybe you saw this, about how the Chinese army had hacked into computer hardware used by some of the biggest tech companies in this economy. Those tech companies, by the way, deny it, we should say. Later, Vice President Mike Pence said in a speech this morning that he expects China to be more proactive than ever in trying to influence U.S. politics. And also some fresh understandings of what the new NAFTA is going to mean for the global supply chain. Under the terms of the New Deal, and yes, I know it is technically the USMCA, manufacturers are going to have to get more of their parts from the three member countries to avoid tariffs, United States, Mexico, and Canada, of course. The thinking from the White House is that that'll force supply chains to shift back to North America, which is to say shift away from China. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has the reality check on that from Shanghai.
Earlier this week, President Trump declared the deal would provide a big boost for North American businesses and jobs.
Going to be a manufacturing powerhouse and allow us to reclaim a supply chain that has been offshored to the world because of unfair trade issues.
And the president might be on the right track, says Henry Gao, a trade expert at Singapore Management University.
Yeah, the new impact would be a reshuffling of the supply chains to the detriment of China.
Some companies have already shifted production out of China because of things like increasing labor costs and heavy regulation. The U.S. tariffs and new USMCA deal have just accelerated the process, says Alberto Vettoretti with Dizan Shira and Associates, a firm that advises foreign investors in China. He says about 10% of his manufacturing clients are starting to set up production lines outside China. But are they, as President Trump wants, relocating to the U.S.?
I don't have a single client that looked at moving back to the U.S. All of them are looking at Asia.
To countries like Vietnam and Cambodia, he says. Trade expert Henry Gao says nations that have a free trade agreement with the U.S. also benefit.
Like Australia, like Singapore, like Korea.
He says, however, that any boost to U.S. manufacturers could be short-lived because China can produce so many things that other countries can't and more cheaply. Michael Zakur with the consulting firm Tompkins International says the USMCA won't dislodge China from its central role in global trade.
China is still going to be an integral part of the world's supply chain, a consumer market, and a major exporter.
He says the CEOs he advises have no immediate plans to shift production. He's telling them to wait and see. He says there are no winners in a trade war. And he's optimistic that U.S.-China trade tensions will soon be resolved. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
One of the constants in this consumer economy the past, I don't know, a couple of 5 years anyway, is that identity theft is the new normal. Every time you turn around, there's been a hack or a data breach that means you have to lock down your credit report. And now apparently you have to lock down your kids' credit reports too. According to Javelin Strategy and Research, last year more than 1 million American children were the victims of identity theft, and it cost their families $540 million to fix or freeze it. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Heather Karpinski lives in Houma, Louisiana. She's got 5-year-old twin boys, Gavin and Grant. She says when her family came home from vacation in August, she noticed that a lot of their mail was addressed to Gavin.
And I opened those up and found some pretty hefty bills. I called the company and they told me that Gavin had been a regular customer of theirs for quite some time. And I was quite surprised.
It turns out somebody had hacked into their pediatrician's computer and accessed Gavin's information. Karpinski filed a police report and
had to send that with a letter, as well as all of Gavin's information, to all three of the credit bureaus, request that his credit be frozen.
She says they're still in the process of freezing Gavin's credit. Jerry Linebaugh is the founder of the consultancy group J-Line Financial. He says kids are especially vulnerable because if an adult's identity is stolen, they're probably going to find out sooner.
Because you're actively using it. Maybe it's a credit card offer. Maybe it's a new home purchase, a car. A kid is totally the holy grail of fraud because no credit is good credit.
Parents can freeze their kids' credit free of charge now, but it's still a process. Elizabeth McQueen lives in Austin, Texas, and has a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old.
Someone recently said, like, you should think about freezing your kids' credit score.
She said the thought had never crossed her mind. Now she's considering it, but it's not really a priority.
I mean, honestly, I have like 1,000,001 things on list to do that I haven't done. And so like freezing my kids' credit score is pretty far down there. But what could it hurt?
It's a question it sounds like a lot of parents will be asking in the near future. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
an Elvis festival in Porthcawl is just so ridiculous, it could work.
It totally could. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 200 points today, 0.75%, closed at 26,627. NASDAQ down 145 points, 1.8%, finished at 78.79. S&P 500 down 23.8%, 29.01. Talked about holiday hiring, right? So we drive over to UPS. It dropped off 0.3%. FedEx lagged behind 0.7%. Those packages got to get where they're going somehow, right? Tech stocks in a slump today after that Bloomberg hack story. Apple off 1.75%. Told Bloomberg, by the way, it has never found malicious chips in any server it offered. Amazon slumped 2.2%. Also disputed details of that report. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You can name the most visited sites on the internet probably off the top of your head, right? Google, YouTube, Facebook, Amazon for sure. Yes, all of those, but you forgot one. Reddit, once called the front page of the internet. It has 330 million monthly average users, a site where users, anonymous users it should be said, can post, and then other users decide how much exposure those posts get by voting them up or down. Christine Ligorio-Chafkin went deep on Reddit in her new book. It's called We Are the Nerds. Christine, it's good to have you on.
Thank you so much.
Why isn't Reddit in the conversation? Why, when big tech companies go to Capitol Hill, it's Google and Facebook and Twitter and not, say, Alexis Ohanian and Steve Huffman, the two co-founders of this company?
The thing is, I don't think they understand Reddit, same as most Americans. I think that there's one reason for that is it's easy to understand the internet and all the little parts of it, even if you're not an avid user of certain sites, if you can see the flow of money, if you can see the ads being bought. Also, money is an easy way to regulate things that are going on online. There's a huge question as to what the power of government is to kind of regulate these little, like, random person-to-person conversations that happen online. If there's not the money to look at and follow and regulate, what's really the point?
Well, along those lines, actually, then, this is going to sound like a naive question, but I'm just going to throw it out there.
No worries.
Well, is there a way for us to understand why Reddit matters, I guess, is a basic question.
Reddit has a little bit of an anarchist spirit. It always has. It's always sort of been thinking about itself as freedom from the press, not having an editor determine what bubbles to the top of a homepage or any given subreddit, but having actual just humans vote on what they like and see that stuff soar to the top of its page. And that's why Reddit is an incredible, incredible virality engine of the internet. You know, any meme you've ever seen elsewhere probably was germinated or spread on Reddit.
It sounds like you're a fan, even though, you know, there are many dark corners of this website.
I don't know if I'd call myself a fan. I'm an obsessive lurker, I would say, is the technical term for my behavior on Reddit. As a journalist, you know, I've been looking at the company for about 8 years now and have just been fascinated to see it grow. It's now a company of more than 400 employees in San Francisco and, you know, four other cities. It's gone through, you know, four CEOs, including Ellen Pao, who is kind of a feminist hero of Silicon Valley, who got basically harassed out of her role as CEO by this community.
So stop right there. So what does it say about this community, right, that a female CEO with bona fide tech chops gets harassed out of her job by members of the community? Hello?
I mean, it shows the insane power of social networks and also kind of the fallibility of them, right? If Reddit's community can revolt against itself, essentially, and almost snuff out its own site. I mean, that's why I think you see some fear in Mark Zuckerberg's eyes when he's testifying before Congress, right?
Well, except for the fact that Zuckerberg owns controlling shares in that company, so, you know, he can do almost whatever he wants, right?
Sure, sure. There's that. As Reddit grows and is now operating as a Silicon Valley company, you know, funded by venture capital, its original creator, the man who hand-coded together the site, Steve Huffman, has come back as CEO.
Right.
So this is also a story of watching his opinion on this noxious content evolve. You saw him ban a lot of behavior related to the alt-right and most recently take down a few conspiracy theories. That's fascinating to see as we watch the other social sites, you know, Twitter and Facebook and others grapple with this same sort of thing, to watch Reddit's more sort of decisive, in certain instances, stance on the matter.
Do you think that with all that's going on in social media, right, with the issues Facebook is having and Twitter being the sometimes cesspool that it is, do you think Reddit is sitting there quietly, right, kind of out of the spotlight, listening and learning and taking its lessons?
Yeah, Reddit's been undergoing a transformation over the past year. It completely redesigned its website. It used to look like, you know, dystopian Craigslist. It was like, I guess there was a quote in Bloomberg Business Week that called it, said that Reddit had all the aesthetic seduction of a phone book, which was true for a full decade. Now Reddit has redesigned. It's kind of brighter and shinier. It's trying to keep its, you know, anarchist spirit to some extent, but also allow people to actually have avatars and usernames and profile pages, which is super foreign to most Redditors who would prefer to stay anonymous. They're trying to open it up for brands and open it up for kind of celebrities to post. And
are they really?
We'll see.
Absolutely. Celebrities. I mean, look at
why
Twitter
on earth
and Facebook,
would you?
Right? God, and Instagram. How to ruin it?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, someone's got to make some money. I think
somebody does. It's called "We Are the Nerds: The Birth and Tumultuous Life of Reddit, the Internet's Cultural Laboratory," by Christine Ligorio-Chafkin. Christine, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Here now, a tale of urban revival in the United Kingdom that owes much to an iconic entertainer from the colonies. The Welsh seaside resort town of Porthcawl, population 10,000, had been on the skids for years. Vacationers had been choosing sunnier climes overseas. But now, the town is enjoying an economic renaissance thanks to the King of Rock and Roll. From Porthcawl, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has it.
With its antiquated fairground and tacky amusement arcades, Porthcawl had been sliding into seedy decline. But then an unexpected figure rode to the rescue.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl, crying all the time.
In 2004, Porthcawl became home to an annual international Elvis festival, the improbable brainchild of PR man Peter Phillips.
The town has no connection with Elvis whatsoever. If you thought of, you know, all of the imagery that goes with Elvis, like Hawaii, Las Vegas, Porthcawl doesn't tick any Elvis box whatsoever.
But the consummate PR man Phillips felt his outlandish idea might attract some publicity.
In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, yes, an Elvis festival in Porthcawl is just so ridiculous, it could work.
And it has, brilliantly. Some 40,000 people throng the town throughout the festival weekend, pumping an estimated $10 million into the small local economy. They flock to see the king. Not in person, of course, but in the shape of Elvis impersonators, like this one.
The stars of you may twinkle in.
There are more than 100 impersonators here, or Elvis tribute artists, as they prefer to be known. Most wear the trademark white jumpsuit, goggle-like shades, and helmet of shiny black hair. Most, like Dave Barlow, are semi-professional.
I work as a van driver, full-time, and I just do little gigs here and there. Some gigs I get paid, mainly to cover my costs. It is an expensive game. But yeah, I do it for the love of Elvis.
The Elvises come in all shapes and sizes, short and fat, tall and skinny, but all strive to sound like the real thing.
Love me tender, love me sweet.
This one is Mark George, voted best Welsh Elvis for 2 years in a row.
You have made my life complete, and I love you so.
Very good, and the lip is curling too, I notice.
Yes, 30 years of practice.
Mark will go to any lengths to look the part.
Are the sideburns genuine?
They are mine. They're all mine.
The hair isn't. That is a wig. Dare we inquire what your hair is like under that wig? Is it not ginger, is it?
No, I have none.
You're bald?
Yes.
The most recent instalment of the festival reached the peak of kitsch on the roof of the Grand Pavilion. Two couples from Australia renewed their wedding vows, drawing inspiration from Elvis's lyrics.
When I first saw you with your smile so tender, my heart was captured, my soul surrendered.
And the ordained minister officiating, himself an Elvis tribute artist, rounded off the proceedings with a sort of secular hymn.
Wise man.
Love of Elvis drives the festival, but money plays a big part too. Visitor Stephen Llewellyn, wearing an Elvis wig and a Hawaiian lei, says you can see the local businesses benefiting.
We all gain from the drinks to the chip shops, the restaurants, everybody gains.
Yes.
So that's why everybody loves the Elvis festival. Elvis and making money, what more do you want?
The king himself might have been amused. The world's biggest festival to his memory, say the organisers, is not in Memphis, but in a small and now reviving seaside town in Wales. In Porthcawl, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out, does Elon Musk still have his job day 58? Remember back in August when the CEO of Tesla tweeted that he was going to take the company private at $420 a share and that funding was secured? And you remember this past weekend when Musk and Tesla reached an agreement with the SEC, that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, that said Musk would step aside as chairman and pay a $20 million fine, a settlement that also said, not for nothing, that the company would monitor Musk's communications? Well, somebody didn't quite get the memo, I think. From Musk's account this afternoon, this tweet, just want, and there's a typo here, he left out the say, but the quote goes, just want to say that the short seller enrichment commission is doing incredible work and the name change is so on point. End of quote. Short seller enrichment commission, SEC, the people supervising his publicly traded company. Get it? All right, we got to go. Dow off 200 today, 0.75%. NASDAQ off 145. That's 1.8%. S&P 500 down 23 points, about 0.8%. Just to be consistent here, the 10-year Treasury, 3.19%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.